That's the Soul Jazz Orchestra with Mojuba. They're out of Canada, believe it or not. On this Monday, May the 4th, 2015, we are going to be taking a legal tour, if you will. We are going to be exploring the legal primer behind last Friday's indictment of six police officers in the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. And I could think of no better person to give us this legal primer, to take us on this legal tour, than Alton Maddox, Jr. Alton Maddox, as you know, is no stranger to this program. He has coursed us through the legal bases for major cases that we have been looking at recently, the Eric Garner case, most notably in New York City, and the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. But before this, Alton Maddox has had a long and successful career in fighting for justice. He has been the reason that many precedents have been established in these cases, especially those cases having to do with police brutality and misconduct and prosecutorial misconduct. I do remind you, however, that for the past 25 years, he has been fighting his own battle because the state of New York illegally has, quote, barred him, not disbarred him, but barred him from the practice of law. It has not at all daunted his spirit. He continues to be what the people call the people's attorney general or the attorney at war. And so I welcome you all today. It is always a great, great honor and privilege to have you with us to share your insights. And I might add, those insights have not been heard anyplace else. The way we have deconstructed these cases and explored other related legal issues, you will not hear them anywhere else. So I want to thank you again for also providing exclusivity of information. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, I want to thank you, Yatrice, for allowing us to have a corner where we can discuss these legal issues. In many instances, we are not given the stage, but we are taking great use of the corner. And so I'm thankful to you for that. And I also may add that you certainly gave me a boost of inspiration and confidence this weekend, having to talk to you, and the optimism and cheerfulness that you really displayed in terms of what you are dealing with really should inspire all of us that everything is possible in this world. And so for that, I want to thank you as well.
Thank you so much. Well, let's get to business here. Baltimoreans were jubilant, as we saw on television. They were in the streets, and they were very happy that on last Friday, the state's attorney general, Marilyn Mosby, announced the indictment and the arrest of six police officers, three of them white, three of them African-American, having to do with the death, the tragic death of Freddie Gray, the young man we saw being basically gathered up like a ragged doll and just thrown into the back of a police van, only to die a week later of horrific physical injuries. But while the jubilation set in, what also should have set in, of course, is the fact that the Fraternal Order of Police has already declared that it intends to mount a very vigorous defense of the officers. It has already claimed that they have done nothing wrong, and it is perhaps the first inclination that there will be a huge legal contest, and it will take some time. What do you think?
Well, I think all of the above is true in terms of what the FOP intends to do. And normally, Yatrice, I don't normally take a detour away from the question that you asked. However, if you would indulge in me, I have to do that today for this reason. When I came on the program, I had an opportunity to hear the last few seconds of Gary Noe, and something that he said was just so profound that I really felt like it was important for me to repeat it, because this has really been part of what I have been trying to say and do and get our people to understand it. And he was talking about the belief systems, and he was saying that one's beliefs really control their actions. And that really falls in with one of the things that I've been trying to promote is the acronym HELP, H-E-L-P, which stands for History, Ethics, Logic, and Philosophy. And so while I won't really get into that today because it's Baltimore is a pressing issue and is very exciting, but I do want to acknowledge to what I heard, and then maybe at some later date we can really get into that as well. But starting with Baltimore, let me say this, because people need to understand there are certain truisms, and I don't care what the situations are, those truisms always apply. And the two things I've always said, that when you're dealing with whites, you have to speak their language, and their language is bilingual, and they only understand legalese and military science. And so if you're speaking anything else, you're just not getting across to them, and that's the reason why so many times we're not able to communicate, because they don't really deal with nothing else other than legalese and military science. They don't want to hear it. And so if you're not talking their language, you're not talking at all. And so when we look at what happened to Baltimore, let us take in consideration that legalese and military science are extremely important in terms of what we saw last week from State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. And that is, she came out with a preemptive strike. And we normally don't see prosecutors engage in a preemptive strike, and she did. And obviously a lot of people were very pleased by the preemptive strike, and that sent a lot of people home. Hopefully, however, people will always remember that the cost of freedom is eternal vigilance. Those are not words spoken by me. Those are the words spoken by the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence. And they, nonetheless, whoever they were spoken by are true. The cost of freedom is eternal vigilance. And so as a people, if we go home and go to sleep and don't recognize that this has to be a 24/7 operation, then we're going to absolutely lose it, particularly given the fact that Ms. Mosby did give those six police officers, and especially the three white police officers, a bone to play with. And given that bone and the fact that they are backed by the Fraternal Order Police, and given the fact that they are going to be committed to winning at all costs, we have to be very concerned how this thing is getting ready to play out. And when we talk about accusatory instruments, an indictment is one of those accusatory instruments. An information, a prosecutor's information, is another one of those accusatory instruments. You can look at the accusatory instrument alone and begin to understand what are the odds of a particular person winning. And in this particular case, the accusatory instrument was written in such a way that it does not reflect reality, and it does not reflect the theory of what happened in Baltimore. Because although six police officers are charged, there's something called Trading Places. I think people may have seen Eddie Murphy in Trading Places can relate to this. In Trading Places, the people that should be at the top or at the bottom, and the people at the bottom should be at the top. And so we look at Baltimore and this accusatory instrument, the three cops who really was responsible for this are now at the bottom of the indictment or the information. And the three cops who really had minimal role in this are at the top. And that means that the three blacks are at the top of the indictment and the three whites are at the bottom of the indictment. And the lead defendant in this now is Goodson. And that really has turned things on its head. And I think that ultimately, if it's not corrected and there are no amendments to this accusatory instrument, the Fraternal Order of Police might be going home with another victory. Particularly when you
consider... But when you say, Alton, when you say that we are having a reversal here with the in terms of who is at the top of the indictment and who is at the bottom of the indictment, how could you make this, how could you arrive at this conclusion simply by reading the charging instrument without knowing what other facts are in play?
Well, I think you have to start with how accusatory instruments are written. And a good place for us to start in this case is the Nuremberg prosecution, where those at the top were those Germans who had real supervisory powers, and those in the bottom had ministerial powers, and those in the middle had administrative powers. And so this is pretty much the way that you can look at an accusatory instrument in the same way. And the present accusatory instrument put Caesar Goodson at the top. Now, I'm not a fan of Caesar Goodson. I'm not a fan of any black cop who just simply lets another cop beat somebody to death. So even though my argument may be beneficial to Caesar Goodson, I am in no way trying to mitigate any punishment that he should receive in this. But the fact of the matter is that Lieutenant Brian W. Rice, who is white, should have been at the top of this accusatory instrument. And the two people that were with Rice at the time were the two whites, Edward M. Nero and Garrett Miller. They were the ones who really intercepted Mr. Freddie Gray and stopped him for because he was engaged in reckless eyeballing, which is a crime that a lot of blacks in the past have gone to the gallows for engaging in, and it shows you that Baltimore has not changed too much from its wicked past, and reckless eyeballing is still a crime in Baltimore. And those three blacks were not present on the scene when all of that occurred. So these three whites were the ones that caused the false arrest in the first place, and they are the ones that should be at the top of the accusatory instrument.
When the instrument was released on Friday, it was the same day that the state's attorney received the police report.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any concerns about whether the state's attorney actually had the amount of time, even though she said that she and her office had conducted their own independent investigation? Is there concern about whether the police report either confirmed or corroborated some of the elements in the charging instrument?
Well, what I think, my belief, based upon how I know the prosecutor's office has behaved in the past, that this was a political decision. And so while she may have had some of these other reports and while she may have read them or while she may have not read them, I think ultimately it came down to a political decision inspired by the economic fathers of Baltimore. And if you've been to Baltimore, I mean, it's one of those cities where a lot of its commercial activity is actually in downtown. I mean, you have the Ravens football team stadium downtown. You have Camden Yards, where the Orioles play downtown. You have the harbor where there are a lot of tourist attractions. All this downtown. You have many of the hotels in Baltimore or downtown. So it's one of those towns where you can easily affect commerce a lot easier than you could in some other cities. And so when you have the possibility of rebellions, the uprising, all of that, that's going to have greater effect than it would have in other cities, because in many other cities, you know, you can, for example, light a match in Harlem, and the people in Midtown Manhattan may not know that Harlem is on fire. That's not necessarily the case in Baltimore. And so I think that a lot of alarm was in play in this situation, because you also have the Preakness that's coming on up, which Baltimore is one of the three venues of the Triple Crown, you know, the other being Louisville and Queens, New York. So I think you have a lot of considerations, and the situation was we need to charge now and ask questions later, because we need to first conduct a preemptive strike to get these folks off the street before they can really do a lot of harm to the commerce of Baltimore.
Well, two things. One, the reckless eyeballing, as you referred to, this is the charge that the interception of Freddie Gray began when police came upon the scene, and supposedly Freddie Gray and their eyes met, and Freddie took off, and they then pursued him on bicycle and cornered him, and that's the whole thing that began. But we have the pronouncement of the state's attorney that the arrest itself was illegal. The claim that he had on his person at the time of this arrest, that a switchblade turned out, she said, to be a knife within the law for him to carry. So we have, in effect, a situation here which is akin to some of the major cases that we've been following that began with this initial interception between the police and individuals that was of questionable, if not outright illegal, quality. So I wanted to ask you about this question. It doesn't seem that in the instruments at all that the question about the police conduct within the claim of departmental procedures was even raised and is even implicated in the charges.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. You mean the switchblade knife? That's
right.
That's the question.
Well, I was asking. In this instrument, it dealt strictly about, you know, brutal force and so forth. But we don't have a sense, at least from what I've read, that the state's attorney is even questioning the fact that the police procedures themselves, the police officers broke procedures themselves, and that there should be some kind of legal consequence to that.
Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. You know, that's why I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt. Because what I'm saying is that while a preemptive strike may have been necessary to bring these rogue cops before the bar of justice immediately in terms of the city fathers and other being concerned about Baltimore burning, I'm saying that clearly her second position has to be, I have to amend this accusatory instrument. That's my argument. And my point is, and that's something that normally happens. I mean, you know, a lot of times you have superseding indictments. So that's something that is not uncommon. But I'm saying that if her intent is to continue with this defective accusatory instrument, then there's going to be a lot of problems. That's all I'm saying. So she has the time to make the changes and to even accommodate some of the concerns that you just expressed. However, if she does not, then that ought to be a clear signal to our community that we got to get into action. I mean, we should already be in motion, but we certainly should be in action if that's the signal that she's going to give to us, because this accusatory instrument does not in any way, you know, satisfies many of the legal concerns that are present. And so my point is, I'm not saying that, you know, what she did was off the rock wall and all of that. I'm just simply saying that now, since she did what she did, she has to now backtrack and clean this up.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways in which her action markedly departed from other DAs that we've seen is that she moved quickly, Mosby did, moved very quickly on the issue of probable cause to support the indictment and arrest of the police officers. Now, is that, if that holds, what would it mean, what would be the impact with regard to other cases where we have seen the DAs take an entirely different tack? They waited forever to even consider arresting police officers implicated, for example, in the Michael Brown case in Ferguson and in the case of Eric Garner in Staten Island.
Well, you know, one thing that we all know is that everybody's presumed to know the law. I mean, so that's applicable standard. So if you go into court and you say, well, I didn't really know that. Well, there's a presumption that you did. And so we're going to move on that you actually knew the law. Now, given that, this is something that I've always said. People have heard me, so I'm not making this up for this particular program because I say it all the time because it's a truism. Lawyers, however, must have the equivalent of a baccalaureate. I mean, now when I say lawyer, I mean black lawyers in particular. Of course, lawyers in general should have the same thing, but, you know, black lawyers particularly should have this. The equivalent of a baccalaureate degree in black history, the equivalent of a master's degree in legal history, and the equivalent of a doctor's degree in military science. And so given that, legal history kicks in here, because when you got a problem, you really have to look at a problem from three stages. You have to look at a problem from black history, and, you know, Dr. John Henry Clark really helped us out in this area if we were listening to him. Because Dr. Clark said some of the more interesting things that have helped us have occurred in the 19th century. And so this becomes a focal point, particularly in black history, and this becomes a focal point where I really focused on in terms of cases like Dred Scott, the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, the Haitian Revolution, civil rights cases, 1883, and all of that. So, you know, if you're practicing law, you got to have an understanding of those kinds of issues, you know, in terms of legal history. And, you know, I one time was conducting a workshop where I actually compiled all of these cases and told everybody that next time we meet, you got to master all of these cases because that becomes incumbent upon your really getting a handle on what this is all about. Now, when you go into legal history, then the case of Terry versus Ohio pops up. And Terry versus Ohio pops up after having accomplished Mapp versus Ohio, in which the Supreme Court, for the first time in Mapp, said that the Fourth Amendment should be applicable to the states. So, you know, it wasn't like the Fourth Amendment is automatically applicable. But now in Mapp versus Ohio, this is what the Supreme Court said, they should be applicable to the states. The problem with that was is that the Supreme Court, right after that, started seeing these urban rebellions. You know, they started seeing towns being tossed. And at that particular time, they said, well, wait a minute, we now have to have a dual system of justice. We have to have the Fourth Amendment for whites, and we have to have stop, question, and frisk for blacks. And that's where things went haywire. You know, so, you know, we've been now seeing all these illegal stops that would be illegal under the Fourth Amendment, but not illegal under stop, question, and frisk, which is given us by Terry versus Ohio. So now you have this situation. Now the question becomes, why hasn't the Congressional Black Caucus raised this earlier? Why haven't they said, wait a minute, how does the Supreme Court carve out an exception for blacks? I mean, how can that be done in the 14th Amendment? We got to have a debate on this right away because it's urgent. Now, because they haven't had a debate on this, then we've seen Michael Brown being shot down in Ferguson, Missouri. We've seen Rice being shot down in Cleveland, Ohio. We've seen Eric Garner being choked to death here in Staten Island. We've seen Walter Scott being shot in the back 7 times, and still nobody raised the critical issue. All of these stops should not have occurred if the Fourth Amendment had applied to blacks. And we still haven't heard anything from the Congressional Black Caucus on this issue. And I just recently wrote a letter to Congressman Conyers and to Congressman Bobby Scott down in Virginia. And I sent copies of it to Senator Scott in South Carolina. I've sent a copy to the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. I haven't heard anything from anybody. I mean, so, you know, even when you write people letters giving them sound advice on issues, they just simply ignore you. But yet, you know, next year we all geared up to vote again. You know what I mean? And that's where plantation politics come in. And that's why we got to have the long-range view on this whole matter.
So this case, therefore, is yet again a reminder of the two-tiered system of justice in America.
Absolutely. It is an absolute reminder of it, because as long as Terry vs. Ohio is on the books, that's what it means. I mean, you can't get beyond that, because the Supreme Court has now said Terry vs. Ohio is the law of the land for blacks. And so, black, you got to understand that. In the same way, you know, in my case, you mentioned I've been out for 25 years. On May 21st, 2015, it'll be 25 years. And it's been 25 years because there's an order on record in the Eastern District of New York which says that for Maddox, who is a descendant of an enslaved African, he has no rights that we're bound to respect. Right there. And every day, blacks are going into the federal courthouse in Brooklyn with that ruling right on the books, because we don't understand the nature of a class action. This is action being taken against all blacks. We think it's personal. And that's part of our problem, is that we have a personal belief system. We don't believe it affects anything but the person who is the victim. You know, anybody else? No, it doesn't affect me. Well, they took him down, but hey, I'm clean. I don't have to worry about it. I kept my mouth shut. This is a class action, and we don't understand what a class action means, and we don't understand that there are no innocent bystanders in a class action.
But in a class action, is the DA, and in this case the state's attorney, as the DA is called in Baltimore, is the DA the office to bring a class action, or should that come from outside of the DA's office?
Well, My suggestion would be, if I was in Baltimore or elsewhere, but certainly people in Baltimore, because of our own mental state as a people, there's no reason why we can't move to intervene. The right to intervene is a legal right. You know, and there's no reason why we can't intervene in a criminal prosecution, because the DA under American jurisprudence is the officer who's supposed to represent the people, but we the people got to be concerned about our own representation. You know, just because you got a DA's office in there doesn't mean that we don't have a right to be concerned as a class as how we are being treated. So, you know, if I was in Baltimore, I would be bringing a class action and ask the court to allow me to intervene on behalf of all the descendants of enslaved Africans to make sure that we are going to get a just result in this case. And so, first of all, it puts people on notice that we are alert, you know, because a lot of times we go through life acting like we sleep. So, you know, if you go and file a class action, they say, well, wait a minute, maybe these people are alert, you know, maybe they're paying attention, and maybe we need to change our act. So, yes, a class action is definitely appropriate in a case like this because she is representing the people. And the people should have the ultimate say-so in terms of how things happen. You know, and this goes back to something that happened with Meg Evers, who really is a person that most of us don't understand in terms of what he was doing. But this is what Meg Evers did with the Federal Communications Commission. He eventually got the Communications Commission to allow all people to intervene in the license renewal process, you know, and we just had a timetable of this last May 1st in which I filed a petition to deny on behalf of all people that were within the listed audience of WABC-TV, and like it is, on the claim that the airways belong to the people and the needs of the people is our history, our ethics, our logic, and our philosophy, which was being served by Gil Noble, which is not being served now by Sundry Bookman on Here and Now.
I want to ask you about the role here. This also, the announcement of the indictment, the arrests of the police officers and so forth, also departed from the norm in that we had a brisk response and it was locally controlled. Although people had been clamoring for federal intervention, Ms. Mosby stepped forward and basically claimed the case, and It is remaining decidedly local. Is this to you a promising signal here, or is there something else behind it?
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, I may not be an unbiased observer on this matter because the current Attorney General of the United States was formerly the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, which is Brooklyn. And for 25 years, or during the time that Ms. Lynch was the U.S. attorney, she became aware of my condition. She became aware of Dred Scott. She became aware of the fact that the federal judges over there refused to respect the Constitution or to respect the suspension order if you thought that was appropriate, which said only 5 years. She's aware of all that. So if she, in my opinion, is not geared up to correct that, then why should I believe that she would do anything? I mean, I know other people have different views on her, but that's just my view because it personally affects me, and she has simply sit somewhere and buried her head in the sand while I have been stewing for 25 years.
I want to talk about this question because one of the contentions that I made is that in these cases, the Garner case, particularly illustrative of the theory here, when people start calling for federal intervention and federal involvement, as they did in Missouri, and all they got in effect was a report and then the departure of the person who made the report and saying, well, look, I'm done. You guys figure it out and take it from here. But in the city of New York, for example, where you've had so many cases of people being killed, choked, shot by police, we also see a decided impotence on the apparatus that really should take full charge of these kinds of cases, and I'm referring specifically to the New York City Council, for example, which has direct purview, direct authority over the police department, over the police commissioner, over the mayor, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
How could this case inspire in other localities a decision by the local powers that are elected to keep track and to keep control and regulate the police department? How could this case inspire not just a resurgence, because it doesn't exist, it hasn't existed, but to inspire local control of all these matters rather than say, for political reasons, we'll give it to the feds, let them figure it out?
Well, you know, one of the things that the Sixth Amendment has been interpreted as saying And the Sixth Amendment is the provision that allows for the right of counsel. The Sixth Amendment says there must be competent and zealous counsel. Competent and zealous. Now, New York has decided that anybody that's competent and zealous will not be a member of the bar. And that's our plight. And many of us, because we only think this is personal, we can't see beyond our nose to recognize that affects everybody. The question becomes, who has been eliminated from practicing law because the legislature and all of the powers to be had decided that that particular person is competent and zealous and therefore should not be providing legal representation to everyone else? Once we resolve that issue of that we have a right to competent and zealous counsel, we can deal with Staten Island. I mean, I know that if I was practicing law today, I mean, Staten Island would be a cinch. You know, it would be no question, because there's no way in the world that they could stop me from doing what has to be done. But because right now we are under the guise of the Silver, SILVERRITES movement, you know, all this stuff is impossible. And we don't want to open our eyes and move on those leaders who are civil, SILVERRITES leaders. And so, you know, the question becomes, you're absolutely right, the city council and all of these forces do have some authority in this matter, but in the final analysis, the playing field must allow for competent and zealous counsel. And at this particular point in New York, competent and zealous counsel is barred from representing anybody.
Do you get a sense, even now as the case is unfolding in Baltimore, do you get a sense as to whether there is a systemic shift occurring, especially among the leadership? Because it would seem to me that the reason for this particular result that came on Friday was that there was a class struggle, a class within the class. The people who were considered, you know, the thugs, according to President Obama, the thugs were the ones, the very ones who kept this front and center in Baltimore. It was their action, it was their energy that kept this thing going. Did you get a sense that there was a class within the class struggle in Baltimore that eventually did yield the result that people started celebrating on Friday?
Well, this is the point, and I start by answering this. First of all, it's the thugs that always keep things going. You know, I mean, if you don't have any thugs, nothing will occur to benefit our people. It was the thugs in these cities, you know, Newark, New Jersey, Detroit, Cleveland, all these other places of urban rebellion. It was the thugs who were keeping that going. In the American Revolution, it was Christopher's Attucks. He was a thug. You know, and if it had not been for the thugs, this country would not be enjoying the rights that it is enjoying now. When Christopher Adams was put on trial, people need to read the transcript. And in the transcript, it was said that it was the thugs that went out there and confronted the British. But obviously, there's a focus there to really try to circle these thugs and to put them in check and to in replace of them, you know, put this propaganda out that everything is now business as usual. And in my point of view, that is a matter of serious concern that we should all have, that in terms of that shift.
So let's take a summary here, Alton, and talk a bit about, from your perspective, what should be expected here at this juncture, as the indictments have been announced, the arrests have been made. Now, what do you expect the legal steps to be?
Well, this is what I expect. I expect that if the thugs do not come out and name somebody as the general and allow the general to dissect what has to happen, it's going to all be for naught. I think that the move now is on the thugs. And the thugs, have to recognize that there has to be some military planning going on, and there has to be a general at the top of the military operations. I mean, in all reality, because, you know, if you're talking about the system taking care of itself, it's not going to do that. You know, that's just a reality. And, you know, I just want to point this out. I mean, we've seen this ourselves. The unfortunate part about it is that we don't write our history. And because we don't write our history, you know, it just keeps repeating itself. You know, but black people, especially those who live here in New York and in the tri-state area, should be well-versed on this because we've had too many instances right here. That, and we're the beneficiaries of that. And yet, you know, we tend to label those who brought about those kind of changes as the thugs and the rest of us as safe people. So that's a real problem. But here, Howard Beach, for example, is a perfect example. Now, you know, the deliberation on the Econ Plast case or wherever the young boy is, I think has exceeded what was going on in Howard Beach. But Howard Beach was a perfect example of military planning.
Could you elaborate a little bit more so people who are not familiar with Howard Beach would get a sense of where you're going?
Okay, well, Michael Griffith, Sergei Sandifer, and Grimes had to pass through Howard Beach. Back in the day, as some people like to say, there were racial restrictions in terms of where blacks could walk and be, especially at night. And so when they had to come through Howard Beach because they had a mishap with their car on the other side of Howard Beach, they were attacked by this mob that ultimately ended up in Michael Griffith being killed. And so then there had to be a special, you know, there was uprising and all of that. And eventually, you know, there was a demand for a special prosecutor, and that whole bit. And then, you know, obviously the negotiators had to go around with special prosecutors because special prosecutor in itself is not a panacea. So you really got to have somebody who know how to bargain and leverage with that special prosecutor. But in any event, the case turned out to, leading to some convictions in Howard Beach. But before there were convictions, there were just long jury deliberations. And so it had to be perfect timing as to how long this deliberation would take place and when should there be a day of outrage. And so, you know, consistent with the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that at some point you got to paralyze these cities, large numbers of blacks took to the streets and took to the railroads and subways and everything else and paralyzed New York City to the point where during the middle of jury deliberations, the jury said, wait, we got to give this up. So that's what we're talking about, proper military planning and having the proper general in order to execute the plan.
And you don't think that that's happening right now?
No, it's not happening right now. In Baltimore at all, because right now there are enough blacks to give people the impression that we got this under control, and they don't. You know, that's the whole point. Yesterday's score doesn't win today's ball game. I mean, so, you know, every day calls for new challenges, and just because you may have been a part of yesterday, we still now got to move to the future, and the future is the conviction of these six rogue cops and how that is going to take place. And I don't see the education that is necessary for that to take place. I don't think you have anybody in Baltimore who has that level of political consciousness that would steer people to what we saw in Howard Beach and then later what we saw in Bensonhurst. I don't see that now. You know, and that's what is needed. And the question becomes the class and whether people in Baltimore can accept those of us who are here in New York, those of us who are living in California and other places, have been a part of that class or not. if they can't accept us as being a part of that class, and there won't be no internal strife, then we may be on our way to something. But if, on the other hand, we show up and somebody says, well, you from New York, and you from California, and you from Texas, and all of that, then we're going to have other problems. And that's what I'm really concerned about, because there are steps that have to be taken. I don't think that, from what I have seen, there are enough people who have the consciousness, militarily and politically, to make that happen.
And what about the concern about the updating, if you will, of the indictments? Do you see that that might be something that you could expect to happen?
No, I don't even think that is going to happen right now, because, you know, reality-wise, Utrice, the radio programs and other places where we can communicate have been shut down. I mean, you know, there were once some host in Baltimore and in Washington that would invite you on. But now, you know, there are no invitations. So even if we are talking about this in New York, we can't get on the Baltimore airways to express to them what has to be done. So I clearly see censorship is in effect. And, you know, this is what's going to rule today, as they expect. If we could get past censorship, you know, then they would have another problem. But unfortunately, we can't. I mean, you and I are witnesses to that, because both of us have to broadcast and participate from somewhere else other than New York City.
Yeah. I want to ask about the significant absence in this whole thing, and that is by the leaders who we have associated with involvement in the case in Ferguson, Missouri, the Michael Brown case, and in the Eric Garner case. They were nowhere to be found in Baltimore, and perhaps there's a reason. Could you conjecture?
Well, my reason is that the people of Baltimore at least had this good sense to look for preventive justice before they started talking about personal justice. And so, you know, you had some attorneys there. While they may not be general in the struggle that may be necessary for the future, but they are at least the kind of people that don't want the silver, SILVERITES movement in Baltimore. And so, you know, and right now there's effort being made to buy our way into Baltimore. You know, we talk about we can repair Baltimore, we can raise certain money and all of that. But right now it seems to be that resistance to these civil rights leaders. And so that at least is something that is significant for where we are, to keep them at bay. But in the meantime, we got to come up with a military plan in order to make sure these six rogue cops are convicted.
Well, Alton, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It is always a learning process whenever you're on the air, because you take us into places where most people don't go, combining history, as you said, with ethics, philosophy, and combining your own expertise with that to give us an entirely different view from what we've been seeing. I've been talking about CNN, you know, positioning itself, and they were covering this thing like it was a kind of game. They standing there waiting for something really ridiculous and horrible to happen so that they would be on spot to say, we rebroadcast it first. But the media organizations have had no really sympathetic history with covering Baltimore and the Baltimores of America. They descend on these areas when they flare up, and it is largely the coverage of, well, the bacteria proliferating, and let's just examine how, and then once we tell you how they're proliferating, the story is over and we go on to the next calamity that ensues. So in that sense, we've been seeing an unfolding of yet another case, but we are also appreciating some significant differences with it, and hopefully we will of course come back to update this as we observe the case going forward.
Well, I think that's very important, Yatrice. I do want to say that this, because I think it's very important for those who listen to this broadcast. You have a knack for bringing out the best in people, and for that, we're all indebted.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it gave you a lot of things to ponder. It certainly did for me. And it puts the case in a brand new perspective so that as we follow the case, and we will, you will follow the case with this unique vantage point, this unique knowledge shared by our guest today, Alton Maddox. Thank you for joining me today, and let's look forward to tomorrow. Always a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.